stand of evergreens. And then I caught up with her. She was standing motionless, staring at something on the ground. To her right, the ancient stacked stone wall that marked the boundary of the estate gardens was thick with dark green moss. Just beyond it was a steep forested slope, and then the public road that led to the front entrance of Withywoods and the grand carriageway entrance. I was panting as I caught up to her, and for the first time I realized that she was very familiar with this section of the grounds. I had never thought of my little child playing so near a carriageway, even one so lightly travelled. "Bee," I panted when I was near enough to speak to her without shouting, "you must never again—"
"The butterfly's wing,"
she exclaimed, pointing, and halted, still as a statue. Her eyes were wide, and when she looked at me, they seemed black, edged with blue.
"Go,"
she whispered softly.
"Go to him."
She gestured with a slender hand and smiled as if giving me a gift. A premonition of disaster rose in me so strongly that my heart, which had previously beat fast from my exertion, now raced even faster with dread. I stepped toward where she pointed. A small black animal burst suddenly from nowhere and streaked off into the woods. I shouted in surprise and halted. A cat. Just one of the feral cats of Withywoods, hunting for mice. Only a cat. I took two more steps and looked down. There, on the deep bed of shaded moss, still mottled with last night's frost, was a butterfly's wing the size of the palm of my hand. There were brilliant panels of red, gold, and deep blue, separated by dark veins that reminded me of the leading in a stained glass window. I halted, transfixed by it.
Never had I seen a butterfly of such size or brilliance,
let alone in the cold days of early winter. I stared.
"It's for you,"
she whispered. She had eased soundlessly to my side.
"In my dream, it was for you. Only you."
In a sort of daze, I dropped to one knee by the strange thing. I touched it with my forefinger. It was soft and pliable as the finest silk. Gently, I pinched the tip of it between my fingers and lifted it. As I did so, it became something entirely different. Not a butterfly's wing, but an airy cloak of impossible lightness. It floated like a lady's veil, and suddenly the colours were revealed as a corner lining of a much larger piece of fabric. The fabric itself was exactly the shades of the moss and the shadows that dappled it, blending perfectly with the ground under the evergreen trees. As I lifted, I revealed more of the gaudy butterfly wing lining of the cloak, and then I uncovered what had been concealed beneath it. The fool. Pale and slight as he had been when we were boys together, he huddled on the bare ground. His arms were drawn in tight to his body, and he was curled up, chin tucked to chest. His ice-white hair was loose, some matted to his cheek, and some tangled against the deep moss. I hated that his cheek was pressed against the cold earth. A beetle crawled on the moss by his lip. He was not dressed for this weather. He had come here from a much warmer place. He wore a long cotton tunic with a pattern of large rust shapes against a wheat-coloured background, over simple loose trousers of a slightly darker colour. He had a boot on one foot. The other was bare, dirty, and bloodied. His skin was alabaster, his eyes closed, and his lips pale pink as a fish's gills. He was still. Then my eyes resolved that the large rosettes on the back of his shirt were actually bloodstains. There was a roaring in my ears and darkness at the edges of my vision.
"Papa?"
B tugged at my sleeve, and I realized she had been worrying it for some minutes. I was on my knees by the fool. I could not say how long I had been transfixed there. "It will be all right, B," I told her, certain it would be nothing of the kind. "Run along back to the house. I'll take care of this." Some other man took charge of my body. I set my fingers to his throat under the angle of his jaw. I waited, and when I was certain there was no pulse, I felt one. He wasn't dead. Not quite. His flesh, never warmed to the touch, was cold as meat. I bunched the butterfly cloak around him and lifted him, heedless of his wounds. He'd carried them for some time. Delaying to be careful of them now would not save him. But keeping him longer in the cold might finish him. He did not make a sound. He was very light in my arms, but then he had never weighed much. B had not obeyed me, and I found I didn't care. She trotted at my side, crackling questions like a sap log in the fire, very much my child again. I ignored them. Her peculiar fit seemed to have passed. It still concerned me, but not as much as the unconscious man in my arms. I would tend to my crises one at a time. Calmly. Dispassionately. Abruptly, I wondered what I was feeling. The answer came to me quite clearly. Nothing. Nothing at all. He was going to die, and I was determined to stop feeling anything about it before it happened. I'd had enough pain with Molly's death. I wasn't going to feel any more. He had been gone from my life for years. If he'd never come back, I wouldn't have experienced any new sense of loss. No. There was no sense in feeling anything about regaining him when it was so obvious I was about to lose him again. Wherever he had come from, he had journeyed a long way to bring agony to my door. I wasn't having it. I found that somehow I had retraced the whole length of my wild garden chase of B. She waited for me by the door to Patience's garden room. I didn't look at her. "Open the door," I said, and she did, and I carried him inside. My mind halted for an instant, fighting to decide what to do, but my body and my daughter did not. She ran ahead of me, opening doors, and I followed her without thinking.
"Put him there, on that table,"
she said, and I realized she had led me to the small workroom where Molly had done her hive work. It was tidy as she always left it, but still it smelled of her and her work, the fragrant honey, the wax, even the musky scent of dead bees from when she had cleaned out a wooden hive. It was actually a good choice, for there were cloths, washed and dried and folded, and buckets, and... He made a small gasping sound as I lowered him to the table, and I caught his meaning. As gently as I could, I turned him, putting him on his belly. He still gave a whimper of pain, but I knew the injuries to his back would be the worst ones. B had watched in silence. Now she picked up two small buckets meant for honey.
"Hot water or cold?"
she asked me gravely. "Some of each," I told her. She paused at the door.
"Honey is good for infections,"
she told me gravely.
"The butterfly man will feel more at home here, for bees are not, perhaps, so different from butterflies."
She left, and I heard her small feet pattering down the hall. I wondered what Riddle thought of my sudden abandonment of him, and what he would say to Nettle and Shade. It was so rude of me. I unfastened the glorious cloak and set it aside. Strange garment. It weighed scarcely more than spider silk. It reminded me of the amazing tent that the fall had brought with him to the Out Islands. I thrust the memory down. I hoped Shun was not feeling neglected. Would her temporary chambers please her? I thought about that carefully, and what excuses I could make for any delay as my hands cut away his bloody tunic. I peeled his garment from his back as if I was skinning a deer. The blood-soaked fabric was stiff as a frozen hide and clung to the wounds. I gritted my teeth and tried to be gentle as I tugged it free. Two of the injuries broke open afresh, leaking watery blood. He lay very still, and only when I had stripped his clothes away did I pause to think how very gaunt he was. I could count the knobs of his spine below the nape of his neck, and his ribs pushed tight against the skin of his back. The wounds had come from some sort of missiles, I guessed. Not arrows, but something smaller that had penetrated deeply. Darts? He'd managed to pull them out, I judged. At least nothing projected from any of the crusted, swollen wounds.
Water,
she spoke in a strange accent, her voice so different from my fool's voice that I knew instantaneously that I had been completely mistaken. The breath caught in my throat. Disappointment drenched me, even as buoyant joy that this dying person was not my old friend welled. What a dizzying trick my mind had played on me, taking me back to my adolescence and convincing me that this was indeed the fool. Yet she appeared almost identical to my recollection of him as he had been in those days. Relief nearly unmanned me more than my previous panic. I held to the edge of the table as my knees bent. Oh, how the years had changed me! Where was my iron resolve, my forged nerves? Would I faint? I would not. Yet I let my knees touch the floor and lowered my head, pretending I stooped to look into her face. She was not the fool. Only her colouring was the same. She had no scent, just as the fool had lacked, and to my wit she was not there at all. But her nose was more pointed, her chin more rounded than the fool's had ever been. However had I looked at her and thought she was him. "The water is coming," I said hoarsely. "I'll let you drink first, then we need to clean up these wounds."
"Are you a healer?"
"No, I'm not. But years ago, I had a friend like you." I halted. The fool had always refused to go to healers. He'd resisted anyone touching his body for such a purpose. I realized that might not be true for every wight. "I'll send for a healer right away."
"No,"
she spoke quickly. Her voice was breathy with weakness and pain.
"They don't understand. We're not like your people."
She moved her head in a feeble denial. "I'll do what I can for you then. Clean and bind your wounds at least." She moved her head. I couldn't tell if she was acceding or denying me permission. She tried to clear her throat, but her voice went huskier.
"What did you call your friend?"
I stood quietly. My heart went to a very still place inside me. He was a jester at King Shrewd Farseer's court. Everyone just called him the Fool.
"Not everyone,"
she gathered her strength.
"What you called him?"
She spoke in a learned tongue, without accent, only the dropped words betraying her. I swallowed fear and regret. This was not a time to lie. "Beloved." I called him Beloved. Her lips pulled back in what was intended as a smile. Her breath was foul with sickness.
"Then I have not failed. Not yet. Late as I am, I have done as he bid. I bring a message for you, and a warning."
I heard a voice in the corridor.
"Let me carry them. You're spilling them, trying to hurry."
"I don't think you should be following me."
B's retort to Riddle was both tart and indignant. He'd followed her to track me. He was still Shade's man. Probably Nettles as well when it came to spying. Useless to try to avoid what was coming. But I could spare my guest a bit of humiliation. I took off my shirt and spread it lightly over her. She still gasped at the touch and then...
"Oh, warm. From your body."
She sounded pathetically grateful. A moment later, Bee opened the door and Riddle came in bearing the little buckets. He looked at me in my woolen undershirt and then at the table. "An injured traveller," I said. "Would you run down to the village and bring back the healer?" That would get him out of my way until I had time to wash and bind her wounds. Riddle stepped in for a closer look.
"She's so pale,"
he exclaimed. He studied her face. She stayed perfectly still, eyes closed, but I didn't think she was unconscious, only feigning it.
"She reminds me of someone."
I didn't let myself smile. I recalled now that he'd never met the fool when he was so obviously a white. By the time Riddle knew him, he was the aptly named Lord Golden, a tawny man indeed. But this girl was as the fool had been in his childhood, pale with colourless eyes and fine white hair. Riddle's gaze shifted to Bee.
And? You're talking now?
Her gaze flashed to me and then shifted back to Riddle. She smiled artlessly up at him.
Papa said I should try not to be so shy around you.
How long have you been able to speak so clearly?
He pressed her. She glanced at me again, seeking rescue. She's lost a lot of blood, I said to hurry him away. It worked. He set the little buckets on the table and turned for the door.
Bring Granny work, I said to his back. She lives at the crossroads just on the other side of the Withy.
And she was older than most of the trees in the area and slow to move. A good healer, but it would take time for him to return with her, and I hoped to be finished with my own ministrations by then. Then the door was closing behind him, and I looked at Bee conspiratorially.
I know you couldn't have kept him from following you, I told her. But do you think you can keep Shun occupied? Take her on a tour of the house that doesn't bring her anywhere near here?
She stared up at me. Her blue eyes, so unlike my own or Molly's, seemed to look past my flesh and bones to the heart of me.
Why is she a secret?
On the table, our guest stirred slightly. She almost lifted her head. Her voice was a whisper.
I'm in danger. Hunted. Please, let no one know I'm here. The water, please.
I had no cup, but there was a honey ladle among Molly's tools. I supported her head as she drank three ladles of the cool water. As I eased her head back onto the table, I reflected that it was too late for me to call Riddle back. He knew she was here, and when he reached the crossroads, Granny Work would know we had had an injured traveller too. I pondered a moment. Bee interrupted my thoughts.
We'll wait a short time. Then let's send Shaky Amos to follow Riddle and tell him that our guest felt better and left on her own, and not to bring the healer after all.
I stared at her in surprise.
It's the best we can do,
she said almost sullenly.
If Riddle has already spoken to the healer, it will put any hunters off her trail, for a short time at least.
I nodded. Very well. Off you go, then. After you tell Amos, then you must keep Shun busy for a while. Show her the house, then the gardens, and then take her back to the parlour and leave her there, while you go tell the kitchen to send up a nice tray for her. Then slip away here to let me know how it all went. Can you do all that? I hoped it would keep her busy as well as keeping Shun occupied. She gave a sharp nod.
I know where Amos takes his naps,
she said. She stood suddenly taller, inflated with importance. Shaky Amos had a decade or so on me and had come as part of the Withywood staff. He was, as his name suggested, afflicted with trembling, the result of a blow to the head many years before. He had been at the estate since Patience's time there, and had earned his quiet days. Once he had been a sheep shearer. That task was beyond him now, but he could lean on a crook and watch the flock on fine days. He liked to be given specific tasks from time to time. He might be slow, but he still had his pride. He'd do the job admirably. At the door, she halted.
So my butterfly man is a girl?
So it seems, I said. Our invalid had opened her eyes. She stared vacantly, and then her gaze fastened on Bee. A slow smile curved her lips.
Where did he come from?
Riddle. He followed Bee here. He's an old friend, no danger to you. Her eyes sagged shut again.
It's so strange. I was so sure the butterfly man was a man, not a girl.
Bee looked annoyed as she shook her head and informed me,
Dreams are not to be trusted. Not completely.
She stood still, appearing to consider that as if it were a new idea. B? Her eyes were far. B, are you feeling well? You were so strange when you came to tell me about the butterfly man. Her eyes finally came to me and then slid away.
I'm fine now. I felt very tired. Then I fell asleep, and the dream came and told me it was time. And it brought me to you, and then...
She looked puzzled.
Then the dream was over, and here we were.
She slipped quietly from the room. For a time I stared after her. Then the girl on the table gave a brief moan of pain. My mind snapped into the now, and I went to work. In the cupboards there were pots of honey, sealed with wax, and slabs of cleaned wax waiting to be transformed into candles. They'd probably still be here a decade hence. I found the cloths Molly had used for straining the honey and the wax. They were stained, but very clean. I remembered how she would wash them outside in a big kettle of boiling water, and then put them on the line to bleach and dry. I chose the oldest, softest rags, and knew she would forgive me as I tore some into strips for bandaging. I softened the scabs on the young white's back with the warm water, and gently cleaned away the blood and ooze from her wounds. There were four of them. I did not want to probe them, but knew personally the danger of leaving anything inside them. I pressed one, and she grunted in pain.
You don't have to search them,
she said breathlessly.
My companion cleaned them as well as he could.
What went into me, there is no taking out. They closed over for a time, and we fled. It almost seemed they were starting to heal. Before the hunters caught up with us, they killed my friend, and I opened the wounds again when I fled. And in the days since, I haven't been able to clean them. Now, it's too late.
She blinked her eyes. Drops of blood like ruby tears stood at the corners of them.
It was always too late,
she admitted sadly.
I just couldn't let myself believe it.
She held a long tale, I sensed. I did not think she was up to telling me all of it, but felt the urgency of knowing the fool's message right away. I'm going to dress these with some honey and oil. I just need to fetch the oil. When I come back, do you think you could give me my message? She looked at me with pale eyes, so like the fool's had been.
Useless,
she said.
I'm a useless messenger. I was sent to warn you of the hunters, so you could find the sun and run before them.
She sighed out long, and I thought she had lapsed into sleep. With her eyes closed, she admitted faintly,
I fear I may have led them right to your doorstep.
Her words made small sense to me, but her anxiety was agitating her and taking all her strength. Don't worry about that just now, I told her, but she had sagged back into unconsciousness. I took advantage of that lapse to fetch oil and dress her injuries. When I had finished, I gathered her cut clothing around her as well as I could. I'm going to move you now, I warned her. She made no response, and I tried to be gentle as I gathered her into my arms. I took a little used servant's corridor and stair, and went by a roundabout path to my own room. I shouldered the door open, and then halted, shocked. I stared at the rucked linens and bunched blankets on my bed. The room smelled closed and sweaty, a boar's den. Discarded clothing sprawled across the top of the storage chest and dangled to the floor. Melted candle stubs littered the mantelpiece. The heavy curtains were closed, shutting out the winter's light. Not even in Shade's messiest days had his den ever looked this dismal. After Molly's death, I had sequestered myself here and ordered the servants to let all things be in the room. I had not wanted anything to change from the last time Molly had touched them. But change they had on their own. The wrinkles in the linens on the unmade bed had become set like ripples in the bottom of a slow river. The light perfume that had always seemed to follow Molly had been replaced with the stink of my own sweat. When had the room become so oppressive? When Molly had shared it with me,
There had not been wax drippings down the candelabra, nor a coating of dust on the mantelpiece. It was not that she had tied it after me, no. I had not lived so brutishly under her roof. The wolf in me curled his lip and wrinkled his nose in distaste at denning in such a fouled place. I thought of myself as a tidy person. This room suddenly looked like the cell of a madman or a recluse. It stank of despair and loss. I could not bear to be in it, and I backed out so hastily that I tapped my charge's head on the doorframe. She made a small sound of distress, and then was still. B's room was just down the corridor. In it, a connecting door led to a small chamber designed for a nurse or nanny. I pushed that door open and went inside. It had never been used for its intended purpose, but had become a storage place for odd bits of furniture. It was not much larger than a cell, but there was a narrow bed beside a dusty stand with a ewer on top of it. An airing rack for linens leaned drunkenly in the corner next to a broken footstool. I dragged the faded coverlet off the bed and deposited my pale victim there, pillowing her head on her butterfly cloak. I built up the fire in B's hearth and left the door open for the heat to wander in. I made a trip back to my room and found a clean blanket in the linen chest. It smelled of cedar when I took it out, and a touch of something else. Molly. I hugged it tight to me for a moment. Then I sighed past my tight throat and hurried back to the girl. I covered her warmly and considered my options. Time was trickling swiftly past me. As I wondered if Riddle was on his way back and if I should maintain the lie once he returned to Withywoods, I heard the door behind me sigh open. I spun, going into a fighter's crouch. My daughter was not impressed. She halted, frowned at me in puzzlement, and then nodded as I straightened.
"I see why you put her here. There's water in my washstand ewer still."
As she spoke, she fetched it from her room and carried it back with her cup. As I filled the cup, she spoke.
"You should go down and tell Tavia I don't feel well, and I need a tray of food in my room. I'll stay here and watch over her while you go find something to keep Shun busy. I confess, that's a task that is beyond me. Are you sure she has come to help us? She seems the most useless person I have ever met, full of sniffs and sighs as if nothing meets her approval. I wouldn't be surprised if she wanted to leave with Riddle when he goes."
"Glad to see you're getting along so well," I said. She looked at me and replied,
"I didn't bring her here to help me, you know."
I heard her mother in her voice and didn't know whether to cry or laugh. "That's true," I surrendered. "You left her where?"
"I took her back to the Mockingbird room, but there's no assurance she's still there. She does have legs, you know, and she's a nosy sort of person. She opened the door to nearly every bedchamber to see if there was one she liked better than the one Revel had prepared. She's not a bit shy."
"Indeed," I agreed. I propped the girl's head up and held the cup to her lips. She opened her eyes to white slits, but she sucked at the water and took some down. I put the cup on the stand beside her. "I think she will be all right for now. I'll tell Tavia that you need a nice warm broth. Try to get her to drink some while it's still warm. Is there anything you really want to eat?" B shook her head.
"Not hungry just yet."
"Very well." I hesitated. "Do you think you can give her some broth if she wakes?" She looked offended that I would ask. I cast a glance at the unconscious girl. She had a message for me, one from the fool. She had warned me of danger already, hunters on her trail. And who did I trust to watch over her? A 9-year-old girl, the size of a 6-year-old. I'd have to do better. But for now, keep watch, and I'll be back as soon as I can. I visited the kitchen, delivered B's suggested message to Tavia, asked them to send food for me to the Mockingbird room, and then joined Shun there. As soon as I entered the room, Mild bustled in to set a fresh pot of tea. When she left the room,
I apologized to Shun for neglecting her. Riddle was called off on an errand, and I'm afraid B does not feel well right now. She has taken to her bed for a few hours. So, I forced a hearty smile onto my face. What do you think of Withywoods? Do you think you can be happy here with us for a time? Shun looked at me incredulously.
Happy here? Who of you is happy here? I have seen only chaos since I arrived. Riddle has left me to my own devices without a by your leave or even a farewell. Your daughter, well, you yourself must know what a strange little work she is. She looks like a boy. If Riddle had not informed me that was your daughter, I would have thought her part of the stable staff here. I do not know what Lord Shade was thinking to send me here.
Somewhere in the house, a workman began sawing something. I felt as if he were cutting into my skull. I sat down heavily opposite her. He was probably thinking you'd be safe here for a time, I said bluntly. Mild came bustling in to set steaming bowls of mutton and barley soup before us, with more bread for the basket on the table. Thank you, I told her. This will be all I require. I desire to have some quiet conversation with Lady Shun. Of course, sir, she responded, and hastened from the room. I waited for the door to close completely behind her before I resumed speaking. It's not the best plan Lord Shade and I have ever cooked up, but for short notice, it's not a bad one. I lifted my spoon and stirred my soup. Chunks of carrot bobbed to the surface and sank again while steam rose in a cloud. I set down my spoon to wait for it to cool and asked her rhetorically, "Can you think of a better one?"
"Yes. Kill the people who are trying to kill me, so I can live as I wish, where I wish."
Her response was so immediate that I knew she had considered it for some time. I decided to take her suggestion seriously. It's seldom as simple as killing one person. First, we must determine who is trying to kill you. And most often that person is merely the tool, not the instigator. For every one person you kill, chances are you've created 6 new enemies. And you might want to ask yourself why that person must die so that you can live your life as you wish. I spoke severely.
A question that perhaps you can put to whoever it is before you kill him,
she responded angrily. She pushed her bowl and plate away from her as I broke bread and spread butter thick on it. When I did not speak, she went on.
Why must I pay for the actions of others? Why cannot I live as my birth made me? What did I do that I must be hidden away? As a noble lady's firstborn, I should rightfully inherit my mother's titles and lands. But no, no, because she was not wed when I was conceived, her shame falls on me. I pay for her selfish act, condemned to be raised in a backwater hamlet by my aging grandparents, to watch them die and then to be sent off to be poured by my mother's lecherous husband. From there, I was banished, near kidnapped by Lord Shade, and then hidden away from all society for 2 years. No parties, not a ball, not one single dress from Bington or Jamalia. No. Nothing for Shun. She was born on the wrong side of the blankets. And above all, the person responsible for that must be able to dodge all consequences of it. And then, even hidden away, where I daily feared that boredom would end my life, someone tried to poison me. In my very own home, someone tried to poison me!
Her words had come faster and faster, and her voice had become shriller as she spilled out her sad little tale. I should have felt sympathy for her, but her manner of telling it was too self-absorbed. Only with extreme restraint did I prevent myself from leaping up and fleeing the room. I fervently hoped she would not break down into tears. She did.
Her face crumpled like a piece of paper written over with too many secrets.
I can't live like this, she wailed. I just can't.
She collapsed forward onto the table, her head pillowed on her arms as she sobbed. A better man than I could have reached into his heart and found kind words for her, could have seen her as a youngster suddenly cast adrift from all that was familiar. But of late, her words were the very ones I wanted to roar at fate every night as I faced my cold and empty bed. I told her what I told myself. Yes, you can. Because you have to. There is no real alternative, unless you want to cut your own throat. She lifted her head from her folded arms. She stared at me, eyes suddenly red, face wet with tears.
Or hang myself. I don't think I could cut my own throat, but I could hang myself. I've even learned to tie that knot.
That, I think, was what made me realize how serious she was. That small bit of information, the step she had taken to be one notch closer to planning her own death. Every assassin knows what his selected exit would be. Not poison for Shun, but the jump from the stool and the snap of her neck, with no waiting, no time to repent the decision. As for me, it would be the slash, the gouting blood, and yes, those few waning moments to say farewell to my life. With a leap of intuition, I knew this was why Shade had sent her to me. Not just because others had threatened her life, but because she was a danger to herself. It incited me to horror rather than sympathy. I did not want the responsibility. I did not want to wake to a maid shrieking that her mistress was dangling from a noose. Did not want to skill such tidings to Shade. It was impossible for me to protect her. What can anyone do for a person who wishes to harm herself? My heart sank at the thought that I must soon search her room. What tools would Shade have supplied to her? Nasty little blades. A garrote. Poisons? Had he even considered that in her state she might use them against herself instead of in her own defense? I felt a flash of anger toward Shade at the bubbling kettle he had sent to my home. Who would be scolded when she finally boiled over? She was still looking at me. You must not do that, I said feebly.
Why not? She demanded. It would solve all the problems. Everyone's life would be simpler. My mother would be happy that her spoiled son would inherit with no cloud on his right. My hidden father would not have to fear that I'd somehow be discovered, and you wouldn't have an inconvenient, half-mad young woman invading your home.
She dragged in a sobbing breath.
When I was fleeing to Buckkeep, despite all that had befallen me, I had hope. Hope, at last. I'd get away from my life in the shadows. I thought that at last I would be at court, with other young people, with music and dancing and life. Just life. And then Lord Shade claimed me. He said I was in danger and I could not go to Buckkeep, but that in his care, once I had learned an assassin's skills, well, then I could both defend myself and perhaps the Queen.
Her voice shrilled higher and choking.
Imagine that, me, at the Queen's side, defending her, standing beside her throne. Oh, I wanted that so much, and I tried to learn all Quiver had to teach me. That awful, smelly woman, and her stupid, endless drills. But I tried, and I tried. She was never happy with me. And then Rono died, poisoned, and it was meant for me. And I had to flee again, sent off I knew not where, with only that ruffian to guard me. This time, I thought, this time surely I will be taken to Buckkeep. But where does Lord Shade put me? Here. I've done no wrong, yet here I am in this drafty place with workmen hammering and where no one cares for me. Where there is no future, nothing lovely and cultured, nothing exciting. Where I'm nothing to anyone, only a burden and a disruption.
One always falls back on one's strongest talents in time of distress. So I lied. You're not a disruption, Shun. I know what it is to feel that there is no place that one belongs or is welcome. So I'll tell you now that, however strange Withy Woods may be to you now, you can consider it your home. You won't be turned out of here, and for as long as you are here, I'll do everything in my power to protect you. You're not a guest here, Shun. You're home. While it may not suit you now, we can make the changes you need. It can be made lovely for you. You can find comfort here. You are welcome for as long as you need to be here. I took a breath and added a small thread of the truth. While you are here, I consider you part of my family. She looked at me, her mouth working strangely, as if she were gumming food. Then she suddenly flung herself from her chair and launched herself at me to land against my chest, sobbing loudly. I caught her before we both fell over. Her voice shook wildly as she said, "They tried to kill me with poison. The cook's little boy stole a tart from the platter, my favorite, a little berry tart, and he died with blood and foam coming out of his mouth. That's what they wanted to do to me, to make me die that way. Poor little Rono, who'd never done anyone any harm save thieving. He died instead of me, and he died in pain. Little Rono." She was shaking all over. I held her firmly to keep from tipping out of my chair. "It wasn't your fault," I told her. "And you are safe now. You're safe." I wondered if that was true.
"Papa!"
I turned my head sharply. Something in Bee's tone told me that she expected me to be ashamed of myself. She stared at me holding Shun, and then crossed her arms on her chest. "Shun's very upset," I told her. But the cold glare Bee was giving me told me that in her opinion, that excused nothing. When Shun did not try to move clear of me, I managed to stand and sat her firmly in my vacated chair. "Are you feeling better, Bee?" I asked to build on my falsehood that she had felt ill.
"No,"
she replied icily.
"Actually, I feel worse, much worse. But that isn't why I came to find you."
She tipped her little head at me, and I felt as if she were drawing back a bow.
"I had to leave my room, just for a few minutes. When I came back, I came to tell you that our other guest is missing."
"Missing?"
"Other guest?"
Shun demanded. "Missing?" Riddle echoed. As he entered the room, he looked tousled, as if he had run all the way back from the village. He was still breathing hard as he looked from Bee's disapproval to Shun's tear-stained face, and then at me.
"The message I received was that the injured traveller had left."
"Yes, she did." I felt like a weathercock as I spun from Riddle to my daughter. "It's all right. She's not missing, Bee. She felt better and wanted to go. I should have told you." With my eyes, I tried to convey to her that I was lying and needed her help to be convincing. She glared at me.
"Injured traveller?"
Shun demanded.
"There was a stranger here. How do you know she wasn't an assassin?"
She caged her hands over her mouth and looked at all of us with alarm. Her green eyes were huge above her tangled fingers. "She was just an injured traveller, one we helped on her way. There's no cause for alarm, Shun." I turned back to Riddle and made a wild leap for normality. "We were just having a bite. Riddle, are you hungry?" It was all I could do to keep my voice level. Tripping over deceit, tangled by my lies, the horrid sinking feeling was all too familiar. Shun's question had shaken me more than I wanted to betray. How indeed did I know that the young wight was truly a messenger, and not someone who meant me and mine harm? Her resemblance to the young fool had led me to bring her into my home with no thought as to her presenting a danger. And then I had put her in the room adjoining my daughter's bedchamber. And now Bee said she was missing, and most likely somewhere within the rambling confines of Withy Woods. Shun had been right. I had definitely lost my edge. I was out of practice at intrigue. My mind raced. The messenger had said that she was being hunted. Had her pursuers entered Withy Woods and captured her and carried her off? In the sprawling old house, it was entirely possible. I had seen her injuries. It seemed unlikely to me that she could present a real danger to anyone, and equally unlikely that she had simply decided to run away, her message undelivered. The silence had hung long in the room. I looked at Riddle.
"I could eat,"
Riddle replied uncertainly. His glance moved from B to Shun, and then fixed on me. Bewilderment that was all his. "Excellent," I smiled like an idiot. "I'll just let the kitchen staff know while you keep Shun company. She's feeling a bit unsettled at being here. I was trying to assure her that she would be safe now. And welcome."
"Warmly welcomed,"
B said in a low and venomous voice. I concealed my surprise and added, "I'll be taking B back up to her room. She's obviously not feeling well." I reached for my daughter, but she sidled out of my grasp and preceded me to the door. No sooner had it closed behind us than she spun to me. I saw her chest rise and fall, and to my horror, tears welled in her blue eyes as she accused me with,
"I only came to tell you she was gone, and what do I see? You hugging that woman!"
"Not here, not now, and you are wrong. Kitchen first." This time I was able to seize her narrow shoulder, and despite her effort to squirm away from me, I marched her to the kitchen. I tersely informed Tavia of Riddle's requirements and left as abruptly as I had arrived, taking B with me. "Your room," I said in a low voice, "now. Stay close to me, and no talking until we are there."
"Is there danger?"
"Shush."
"What about Shun?"
"Riddle is with her, and he is far more capable than most folks credit him. You are my first concern, always. Be quiet." My tone finally silenced her, and she actually slunk closer to me as we wended our way along the corridors and then up the stairs. When we reached the door of her room, I took her by both shoulders and stood her with her back against the wall.
"Stay here," I breathed. "Do not move unless I call you. If I do so, come quietly and immediately and stand just behind my left side. Understand?"
Her eyes were wide, her mouth hanging open as she gave a short nod. I nodded back. I eased the door of her room open. Before I entered, I evaluated all I could see. The bed and hangings, the curtained windows, the hearth. All looked as I had left it. I stepped in silently and checked behind the door before I made a more thorough inspection of B's room. There was no sign of an intruder. The untouched tray was on a stand by the bed. I stepped to the connecting door. It was ajar. I stepped back. "B?" In a flash, she was at my side. "Did you leave that door open?" She was plainly terrified as she shrugged and admitted in a breathless whisper,
"I don't remember. I think so. No, you did, and I didn't move it."
"Stand still." I stepped to the door and opened it the rest of the way. The small room was dim, for it had no window of its own. Nothing there but the rumpled blanket on the bed. I ducked to glance under the bed. It was the only possible hiding place in the little room. No one was there. Of our guest, there was no sign save the ewer of water and the bedding pushed into a heap on the wall side of the narrow cot. I stepped back and shut the door. She's gone.
"That's what I told you."
"And now I'm certain that she's not in this room. And that's all we really know." I marshaled my thoughts. "Tell me exactly how you discovered she was gone."
I stayed in the room here. Tavia brought up the tray of food and set it on the little table for me. I went into the girl after Tavia was gone. She was barely awake. I tried to give her some broth, but it only seemed to make her cough. Then she closed her eyes and went back to sleep. I sat here for a time. Then I needed to use the guard rope. So I did. And when I came back here, I went to the room to check on her. But she was gone.
Gone, I thought. How long were you gone?
Only a few minutes.
Her eyes were very big. B, for the rest of this day, you are at my side. And if I tell you to do something, no matter how strange, you will do it instantly. Understand? She bobbed a nod. Her lips were red against the pallor of her face as she breathed through a half-open mouth. The terror in her eyes was an expression I had never wanted to see on my child's face.
Why are we afraid?
She demanded. We don't know if we need to be wary. So until we do, it is safer for us to be afraid. Chapter 16. Honored Guests. White as ice, eyes the same color, hair the same color. They come, but seldom, maybe once in every third generation, or four. But we remember them. They walk among us and choose one of us, not as servant or friend, but as a tool to shape a future only that one can see. If, no idea how to translate this word, then they are all of one color. Over time, they breed upon, phrase obscured by stain, either a man or a woman, of their own kind or one of ours. But their offspring are not of a term that matches our own. So they may leave, and it is years later that, this portion of the scroll so badly held by insects that I can add only isolated words and phrases to it. Elderly, a large gap, pale, a gap of I estimate 7 lines of text followed by older than its years. Another large gap of at least 2 lines ending with more merciful to kill it. The rest of the scroll scorched away. Partial translation from the desk of Fitzchivalry Farseer.
So in that one day and a night, and the next, my life changed. I remember how angry I felt about all of it. So many changes, and they all affected me. Yet no one asked me if I wanted any of them. No one ever asked me anything in those days. First, there was Shun, put for now in a room but 2 doors away from my own and my father's, until grander chambers could be prepared for her. My father had ordered that the yellow suite be renovated for her. She would have a bedchamber, a small sitting room, a room for her maid, and another room, to do whatever she wanted with, as my father put it. I had always loved the yellow rooms, and had often crept in there to play. No one thought to ask me if I would have liked to have a set of rooms like those. No. A single bedchamber and a tiny adjoining room for a non-existent nursemaid were considered enough for me. Yet a stranger came to our home, and my father brought in a whole army of carpenters and stonemasons and cleaning staff, and even a maid to wait only on Shun. Then there was the peculiar stranger he had put into the little room that opened to mine. He did not ask if he might put her there, he had simply done it. I had told him I understood why, and thought that he might thank me for being so understanding of how rude he had been. Instead, he had just nodded curtly, as if he expected me to simply accept anything he did. As if I were his conspirator in some plot, rather than his own daughter. Certainly, he expected me to support his lies to Riddle and Shun, and to obey him precisely after he discovered that I had told him the exact truth. The butterfly girl was gone. And I did. I obeyed him without question that evening. He worked quickly, taking a blanket from my chest and handing me an armful of my mother's scented candles. He made me walk in front of him where he could see me, and so I led him to his private study. He hurried me there, halting me twice with a grip on my shoulder to pull me aside from where a passing servant might see me. When we reached his private study, he shut the door immediately, bolted it, and went straight to the false hinges. "What are you doing?" I asked him.
"Hiding you,"
he replied. He did not speak sharply, but with a finality that brooked no questions. He lit one candle for me at the fading fire in the hearth.
"In you go,"
he told me, and then he followed me in, as if to make sure no spy had penetrated our secret place. I saw his brows lift in surprise at the changes I had made.
"You've been busy,"
he said, with grudging admiration. "You seemed to have little time for me, so I found something to do." I wanted to rebuke him for how he had ignored me, but his smile at the changes I had made warmed me too much. He was proud of me. I could not be as stiff as I wished to be.
"You're clever. All of this is well thought out."
He pushed the lit candle into my holder. Some tension seemed to go out of him.
"You'll be safe here until I am sure that there is no danger to you. I have to leave you here now, but I'll be back as quickly as I can."
"Will you have to check every room in Withywoods?" His eyes darkened as he saw that I understood what he feared.
"I can do it."
I doubted that was possible. So many strangers have come in and out in the last few days. Why do you fear this one so much?
"There's little time to talk, dear. The sooner I'm about this, the faster I can come back for you. But I fear her, because I trusted her far too quickly, without thought. She might not be a danger, but danger may have followed her. I was careless. I won't be again."
He left me, backing from the small chamber into the narrow corridor.
"I have to latch the door behind me, but don't fear. I'll be back."
I would have feared if I had not already prepared my own bolt hole through the pantry. I watched him go, and then I put my eye to the peephole and saw him close the secret panel. He turned and looked right at me and gave a nod before he left his den. So, there I was. I was glad I had thought to provision my hiding place. I sat for a time, mulling over everything that had happened. It was too much for such a short time. Shun. I didn't like her. My dream trance. I wondered if I should have been frightened by it instead of exhilarated. Why had I felt that way? I tried to make comparisons for myself. I was like a plant that had bloomed for the first time. No. More like a baby when it first discovers it can reach out with a hand and see something. A part of me had been growing, and today it had finally worked exactly as it was meant to. I hoped it would happen again soon. I wondered why I'd had to explain it to my father. Did not all people have dreams, and thus have dream trances? I tried to remember who had taught me that dreams were important, that they must be recorded, and that the most important dreams would seize me and hold me until they were fulfilled. I laughed aloud when I realized when I had learnt that. I'd dreamed it. I soon began to wish that I had thought to provide myself with some sort of pastime. I took out my journal and wrote a fair account of the last day, but that was done quickly enough. On the best piece of paper I had, I wrote an account of the butterfly dream, a much more detailed account than I had ever written before. I set it and my journal back on its little shelf and watched my mother's candle burn. It was exceedingly boring. I thought back to what Wolffather had told me and my promise. What had my father meant when he told me to stay here? Why, only that I must stay hidden in the wall labyrinth. I assured myself of that several times. Then I took a bit of my chalk and wrote on the wall that my father should not worry. I'd gone to explore the corridors a bit, and that I would take chalk and an extra candle and mark my way. I went first to the peephole that looked into my room, hoping again to find some secret entrance. Again, there was nothing I could discover. I had begun to understand the passages and how they wound their ways through the walls of the house. They were best in the oldest part of the house, as if a builder had planned them there. In other places, they went only a short way and were almost impossibly narrow or so low that my father would have had to crawl. I worked my way through the one that went past my room and was disappointed to find that there was no peephole into the room that had been temporarily given to Shun. I pressed my ear to the panelling, but could hear little. Maybe someone was weeping in the room. Maybe I was imagining it. I wondered if she was even in the room right now. I had been a bit frightened when my father had first spoken of bringing someone into our home. Now, I wasn't frightened. I was angry. I didn't like her, I decided in that moment, and justified it by deciding that she didn't like me and that she wanted my father's attention. I wasn't sure why that made me uneasy, but it did. I needed my father now, more than ever, and it wasn't right for her to come into our home and take up his time. Locating the yellow suite was more difficult, but eventually I made my way there. When I judged I was near, I held my candle high and was rewarded by the sight of a little door that could be swung to one side, a peephole cover. But when I moved the door, all I found was a small glob of damp plaster pressed through what had been a peephole. The most recent round of repairs to the rooms had involved some plastering. They had covered over the hole. Now, I decided, was not the time to tamper with it. The plasterers might be back the next day, and I did not wish to call their attention to the hole. I would let it dry, and later I would return to cut it out like a plug. I wandered the hidden maze a bit longer. I visited my pantry exit to be sure it was still as I had left it. While I was there, I filched some dried apples and plums from my hoard. I had climbed onto a barrel to reach the pepper sausages when one of the kitchen cats wandered in. I ignored him. Stripey Cat was not really his name, but it was how he was called. I became aware of his stare as I was trying to clamber on top of the boxes of salt fish to reach the higher shelves in the pantry. I looked down from where I teetered to find him gazing up at me with round yellow eyes. He stared hard, as if I were one of the rats he was supposed to kill. His look froze me where I was. He was a big cat, heavy-bodied and thick-limbed, a cat for the ground rather than a climbing cat. If he chose to leap on me and attack me, I would not be the winner. I imagined those sharp claws sunk into my shoulders and his hind legs ripping at my back. "What do you want?" I whispered to him. His whiskers perked forward and his ears tipped toward me. Then he shifted his gaze to a row of bright red sides of smoked fish hanging from a string stretched across the pantry. I knew why they were hung so high. It was so the cats could not get them. But I could reach them. I had to stand on my tiptoes to break one free. The flaps of salt-glazed fish had been threaded onto the string like peculiar beads. Once I had my hands on one, I bent it until it broke. When it gave way, I lost my precarious balance and fell from the top of the boxes to the pantry floor. I landed hard on my hip and side, but managed to keep from crying out. I lay for a time, clutching the stolen fish and sausage while breathing past my pain. Slowly, I sat up, bruised, but not much more than that. Stripey Cat had retreated to a corner of the pantry, but hadn't fled. He watched me. Or more specifically, he watched the fish that I still clutched. I caught my breath and spoke softly.
"Not here. Follow me."
I stood, hissing at my hurts, and gathered up my dried fruit and pepper sausage. Then, clutching my trove, I dropped to my knees and crawled behind and under my barricade of boxes to where my secret hatch was ajar. Once inside, I moved out of the way and waited. After a few long moments, a whiskered face appeared in the dim circle of light. I moved my candle back and beckoned to him. Some people talk to cats. Some cats talk to people. It never hurts to try. If you will follow me in here and spend a day killing rats and mice back here, I will give you this whole slab of fish. He lifted his striped face, opened his mouth, and turned his face from side to side, taking in the scents of my warren. I know it smelled mousy to me. He made a low noise in his throat, and I felt he approved the prospect of hunting as well as the fish. I'm going to put this up in my den. When you've killed the rats and mice, come tell me. I'll give you the fish and then let you out again. His round yellow eyes met mine, and I had no doubt that he understood our bargain well. He brushed past me, head down, tail straight. Once his tail was well clear of the hatch, I pulled the small door until it was almost entirely closed. I picked up my candle and took the fish, sausage, and fruit back to my den. But even with my explorations, I spent a long and dull afternoon behind the walls. I wished I had stolen more of my father's old writings to read. I wrote about the cat, took a nap bundled in my blanket, ate some fruit and drank some water, and then waited. And waited. When finally my father returned to open the door for me, I was stiff and sore from being still so long. I had been watching for him, and as soon as he opened the panel, I was out. "All safe?" I asked him. And he nodded wearily.
"I think so,"
he amended.
"There is no sign of her anywhere in the house, though as you know, it's a big house with many rooms. None of the servants has commented on seeing her. It's as if she vanished."
He cleared his throat.
"So I believe the servants know nothing of the missing girl. And I've insisted to Shun and Riddle that she left."
I followed him out of the secret den and into the corridors of Withywoods. I was silent. I knew hundreds of places to hide in our house. My father could not possibly have searched them all. Surely he knew that. I walked for a time at his side. I thought carefully, and then said, "I should like a knife and a sheath, please, like my mother always wore." He slowed his stride, and I no longer had to hurry.
"Why?"
"Why did my mother always have a knife?"
"She was a practical woman, always doing things. She had a knife to cut a bit of string, or trim back a bush, or cut flowers, or cut up fruit."
"I can do all those things, or could, if I had a knife."
"I'll see about getting you one, and a belt sized for you."
"I should like to have a knife now." He stopped then, and looked down at me. I looked at his feet.
"B, I know that you are a bit afraid, but I will keep you safe. It's right that you should have a knife, for you are old enough to be sensible with it, but..."
He halted, floundering. "You don't want me to stab someone if they're threatening me. Neither do I. But I don't want to be threatened and not have anything at all to protect myself."
"You're so small,"
he said with a sigh. "Yet another reason why I need a knife."
"Look at me."
"I am." I looked at his knees.
"Look at my face."
Unwillingly, I shifted my gaze. My eyes wandered over his face and met his eyes for a moment. Then I looked aside. He spoke gently.
"B, I will get you a knife and a sheath and a belt for it that you can wear. More than that, I will teach you to use it as a weapon. It's not going to happen tonight, but I will."
"You don't want to?"
"No, I don't. I wish I could feel like it was something you didn't have to know. But I suppose you do. And perhaps I have been remiss in not teaching you before this. But I didn't want you to live that sort of a life."
Not being prepared to defend myself doesn't mean I'd never have to fight for my life.
B, I know that is true. Look, I've told you what I'll do, and I will do it. But for now, for tonight, can you trust me to protect you and let this be?
Something tightened in my throat. I spoke to his feet, my voice gone hoarse and strange. How can you protect me when you are going to be looking after her and keeping her safe? He looked shocked, then hurt, and then tired. I watched out of the corner of my eye as the expressions flitted across his features. He composed himself and spoke calmly.
B, you have nothing to be jealous about or to worry about. Shun needs our help, and yes, I will protect her. But you are my daughter, not Shun. Now let's go. You need to brush your hair and wash your face and hands before we go to dinner.
Will Shun be there?
Yes, and Riddle.
He wasn't trying to make me trot, but my legs were short. When we walked at his normal stride, I always had to hurry to keep up. I noticed that the house was quieter. I surmised that he had sent the workmen home for the evening. I like it when the house is quiet again.
I do too. These repairs will take some time, B, and we will have to put up with noise and dust and strangers in our house for a while. But when they have finished, things will go back to being quiet and calm.
I thought about dinner tonight, Shun and Riddle at the table with us, and breakfast the next day. I thought about walking into a room in my home and finding Shun there. Would she walk in the garden rooms? Would she read the scrolls in the library? Now that I thought of her wandering through my home, it suddenly seemed as if I could never be unaware of her presence. How long will Shun be here? Somehow, I doubted that quiet, calm, and Shun would dwell in the same house.
As long as she needs to be here.
He tried to speak firmly, but now I heard the dread in his voice. Clearly, he had not asked himself that question. I liked that he disliked the answer as much as I did. It made me feel better. He escorted me to my room. I washed and combed my hair. When I left the room to go down to dinner, he was outside the door waiting for me. I looked up at him. "I like that you shaved off your beard," I said. I had noticed it that morning, but not commented on it then. He glanced at me, nodded once, and we walked down to the dining room together. The servants had put us in the big dining hall, but had only lit a fire in the nearest hearth. The other end of the room was a dim cave. Riddle and Shun were already seated at the table, talking, but the vast space of the room devoured their words.
"And here we all are,"
my father announced as we came in. He had good control of his voice. He sounded pleased that all of us were there. He seated me at his right hand, as if I were my mother, drawing out my chair for me and then pushing it in when I perched on it. Shun sat to my right and Riddle to his left. Her hair was pinned up and her dress looked as if she had expected to meet the Queen in our dining room. Her face was freshly scrubbed, but cold water had not bleached all the pink from her eyes. She had been crying. Riddle looked as if he wanted to cry, but had a smile hooked to his cheeks instead. As soon as we were seated, and my father had rung the bell for the food to be brought in, Shun spoke.
"You didn't find any other sign of the stranger?"
"I told you, Shun, she left. She was an injured traveller, no more than that. Obviously she didn't feel safe, even here, and as soon as she could move on, she did."
Two men I didn't know came into the room carrying in platters. I looked at my father. He smiled at me. They served us soup and